Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Review, an opportunity to sit down one-on-one with a mover and shaker in the entertainment business. Today's guest actually wears a couple of different hats. He's a published author, but he's also a publisher. His company is a small independent house, History Publishing Company. Hello, Don, and welcome to the show.
Well, hello, Simon, and thanks for having me in.
Well, let's start with the publishing hat that you wear.
Okay.
History Publishing is it's a bit of a niche company. You only deal with history. I guess people would be able to figure that out from the name. But you're actually a niche within a niche. Tell us what it takes to get that coveted HPC logo on a book.
Well, Simon, to get published by History Publishing Company, the story has to be one of an individual who has participated in the making of history or has been a very close witness to it on an ongoing basis. It is primarily, you could call it a memoir, if you like. That's a very good term for it. It's usually done by the person who was actually there, and he gives us a slice of history and brings it alive. History to History Publishing Company is not the type of book that's filled with footnotes and dates. This is the kind of book that brings you, the reader, alive. It takes you into the story, and it takes you alongside the protagonist or the author. So there's a certain enjoyment factor to reading a History Publishing Company book. It's something that comes alive, and you go for an experience.
Now, I know that History Publishing has not been around for a long, long time. This is actually your second career, I believe. Tell me a little bit about the history behind History Publishing.
Well, I came out of retirement, you might say. I had a company that I sold about 8 years ago, and I came out of retirement, if you can call it that. I was to go into the study of the American Civil War. Now, this was done inadvertently, you might say. I was taken into the Civil War by a professor at Columbia who was chatting with me about it, and I had expressed the fact that I thought that it was a study that was becoming increasingly difficult for teachers to demonstrate the intensity of it and the scope of it. So I had explained to this professor that it might be a good idea if we could come out with some illustration that would do that. And she said, it was a lady who said, well, why don't you do it and see what comes out of it? So we came up with this. We worked out together. We came up with this Civil War History Scope series, which was four visuals, which truly reflects the intensity and the scope of the war. A student, for example, could look at this and be overwhelmed by how vast it was. Everything is color-coded. It shows 384 major battles by the theater of operation, and each battle indication is color-coded to indicate the size of the battle and who won it. So that was the beginning of my publishing efforts. And then I decided 2 years later, after we worked very successfully with this, by the way, at Gettysburg at the National Park, they feature it down there and they sell it. And so we had a nice little market for it, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. So I wanted to go into book publishing. So 2 years later I did. And to get started, I decided, how do I get a book? So I decided I would write my first book, which was The Words of War, which was a comparison of the American Civil War's 18 battles, I should say, of the Civil War, and as written up by the New York Times and the Charleston Mercury. This was to show how political perspective is altered by, or I should say, one's perspective is altered by one's political beliefs. So you could see how the Times covers, for example, the Battle of Gettysburg and how the Charleston Mercury covered the same battle, and you could see how they saw things so differently.
I loved the book. I thought it was a delight to read, and I can certainly recommend it to anyone that's listening into this program. In fact, Don is kind of cutting himself short here. The book actually looks at 18 battles, but it's not just from two perspectives. He gives an introduction, which gives the reader an idea of what was going on. Then we have quotes from the two newspapers, one obviously from the north, one obviously from the south, and a fourth part, which is today's official history of the event. I've never seen a book written like this, Don. Where did you get the idea from?
I was lying in bed one night and it came to me. It was, I liked the idea of the New York Times, the reportage. And then I became familiar with the Charleston Mercury's editor a while back, and then I thought how interesting it would be to show how they saw things during that war period, and then I decided I would take 18 battles and show how each one covered it. It was really a matter of an idea being developed and then taking it to the next step. It was a comparison of the battles, and then I decided later on I'd do the introduction to each battle, and then I decided after that that I would wrap it up with a look at it by the historians of today. So this way you could actually see three perspectives of the same battle.
Well, yeah, actually four perspectives. We have Don's perspective, and we have the historian's perspective.
Well, I tried to give a feel for the times and on my perspective. True, it was all related to the battles, but it was like an inside snapshot at what happened to one or two individuals at the time. And this way the reader could get a feel for what was going on, the chaos or the uncertainty or the fear, or even the laughable moments that might have occurred. So this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to give the reader a feel for it from the perspective of the participant, one or two of them, then give the overall perspective of the two different viewpoints of the same battles. And then, so the reader would not leave confused, I decided I would give the wrap-up, if you will, on the part of the historians of today and what they said about the battle. So by the time we moved across the 18 of them, we pretty had a good idea as to how people can look at things at the same thing and see things differently.
Oh, I thought it was absolutely fascinating reading. You know, much is made of how today's popular press tends to put spin on things.
Mm.
And you read a book like Words of War, and you read about one battle, two different views. It's hard to believe they were even covering the same story.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's the case. For example, the Battle of Hampton Roads, the Monitor and the Merrimack. The Charleston Mercury only covered the first day when the Merrimack sank the wooden ships, and then it didn't really say too much about the second day when the Monitor came down and neutralized the Merrimack. And that's the one that the Times did a wonderful job on. So everybody sees things the way they wanted to. The Charleston Mercury never admitted that Lee lost at Gettysburg, for example. Political belief takes a stranglehold on people sometimes, and it suppresses what they really should be saying because their emotions get involved, and they don't have clarity of mind at all times. And that's a shame, but that's the way it is. We human beings are so imperfect that this is what happens. And this is a cause of media bias. It's the emotions that get involved rather than the mind. And it all started back, newspapers, by the way, if I can just inject this, newspapers started out in the United States as organs of propaganda. They weren't meant to be objective reporters of the news. That didn't happen until the Civil War. Prior to that, from the American Revolution on, they were largely organs of editorial rant designed to reinforce or support a politician or a party. They were owned outright or rented out by them, you might say, through subsidy.
So in fact, nothing has changed.
It's back to that. we're going full circle.
So where does history publishing get their raw material from? Agents?
Is it some agents? And I get a phone call, perhaps. Someone will say, I saw your website. Can I send you in a manuscript? And they'll tell me about it. And if I think it'll work, I'll say, yes, please do. Or an agent will call me. I've had that happen more and more lately as we go on. And then I'll just get a bundle in the mail, the so-called over-the-transom kind of thing. And sometimes that works. I've published books from all different areas. Unfortunately, most of them I didn't, because many of them just don't fit into what we do. Some people even send me novels, which I don't touch, but some of them are good, and I really regret not being able to use them, because when you see a good work, but if it doesn't fit into your genre and it doesn't represent your signature, then it really wouldn't work well for us, and we probably couldn't market the book as well as it should be marketed. So
actually, that brings up an interesting question. The book industry is a brutal one.
Mm-hmm. Right?
The man in the street does not understand this.
Right.
According to the Boker Company, who are the undisputed kings of counting literary things,
right,
something like 300,000 new titles hit the presses in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the U.S. The battle for shopping mall bookstore shelf space is fierce.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the bookstore owner is in the business of selling books and trying to make a living. So they stock whatever the New York Times tells them are the best sellers. In my mind, the big publishing houses have these small stores hogtied. They force the store not only to take the best sellers, but also their, you know, less well-known books. The net result, there's little shelf space left for independence.
Mm-hmm.
How does someone like History Publishing tackle this issue?
Well, the way we tackled it was we got a distributor. That's the key to an independent publishing house like us. We need distributors, and there are several out there. Not a huge number, unfortunately, not enough, but there are some good ones, and we have a good one, Midpoint Trade Books. And they get us into Barnes & Noble and Borders and the various chains. So companies like History Publishing Company, we survive based upon the chains. It's very difficult for us to get into the independents because we're young and we don't have the network of distribution that Random House would have with Harper's. They have sales reps who go out and unveil the line. They'll go into a bookstore and spend several hours going over a whole line of books. And they get tied up into that, the bookstores do. So we can't do that. We don't have 100 titles at this point. Most of us have less than that. So this is the problem we have. So the way I did, I focused on getting a good distributor, which I did do, and then they would get us into Barnes & Noble and Borders and Powell's and the various chains around the country. So that's where independents like myself must go, but out of necessity. It's very difficult for us to get into an independent bookstore The cost of marketing it is almost prohibitive. How would you do this? You go traveling around with a handful of titles or 10 titles, maybe a 20. You just right. wouldn't pay.
Yeah, pile them in the trunk of your car. Go driving.
Yeah, that's the old. Yeah, that's some chicken soup for the soul made it that way. But they self published.
Yeah, they did indeed.
Mm, they did. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned a term, self published.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me rant for a moment. I say this based on the fact that I am a book reviewer. I read probably more books in a month than most people read in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, there are really three very distinctive layers to the publishing industry. And interestingly enough, if you use a scale of quality of books published versus quantity of books published, you find that it's inversely proportional. The highest quality and yet smallest quantity of titles comes out of companies like HPC, or your friend Eric Kampman. I can't remember the...
Beaufort Books.
Beaufort Books, yes. The independent guys, you always have top-notch editing, and you always produce a product that's an absolute pleasure to read. Next up, or further down the ladder, if you will, are the mega houses, the puppy mills of literature.
Mm-hmm.
Over-edited, boring, dry, tend to be non-controversial. It's the fodder of the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, I can't remember the last time I read a book that made it to the New York Times bestseller list that I read and enjoyed. And at the very bottom layer is print on demand.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers of titles are so prolific, but they're often absolutely appalling in quality. Now, there are exceptions, but generally, when I open a package in my mailbox and I see that dreaded iUniverse or BookSurge logo, you know, I want to crawl up on the ground and suck my thumb, get into that fetal position. You know, is that a fair summary of the book industry?
Well, I would say that your assessment of the self-published book is probably more accurate than not. But I would say, in all fairness to some of them, that there are some books that have been self-published that are really quite good because the author took the time to turn it over to a professional editor before we ran it through the mill. But most folks don't do that. They think that they don't need editing. They give it a once-over, and they will hope and pray it works. I just don't think that self-publishing is can be just looked on totally that way, although largely it is. I agree with you on that. But once in a while, you get these wonderful books that come through that are self-published. But POD is a term that was synonymous with that early on, but it's getting away from it a little bit, because print-on-demand's quality has improved dramatically. The technology's gotten better. But larger companies, and I'm not going to mention any, we haven't done it at this point, but larger firms that you had mentioned before do it for short-run items, for books that they don't think will have a big run. They'll do a very short run on POD, and then hopefully it'll work on a backlist. So that's what's happening. There's a lot of change going on in that right now. But I think your focus or your point on the self-published book and the lack of quality is, I'm afraid it's more true than not, because a lot of folks don't realize the value of an editor. But an editor is expensive. That's really why they don't do it. A good editor, is, if you have to turn a book over that's not that good, it could run anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000, and I don't think a lot of people who are writers having a self-published book out there want to go to that expense, and they just hope for the best.
Right. In fact, I read a book last year. The storyline was superb. It had bestseller written all over it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so badly edited.
Mm.
And I had no wish to upset the author, so when I spoke to him about it, I, you know, couched the question carefully. And indeed, he had employed a top-notch editor at, you know, very high price. And he was so appalled by the end result, he spent an additional 16 months unediting the book.
Unediting it.
Yes.
That's a terrible thing. My goodness gracious. I'm sorry. I feel sorry for that author. That was a shame.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know what to say. It's not often I'm speechless, but that was definitely one of the occasions.
I never heard of that before.
No.
That's amazing.
Look, let's move on to a happier subject.
Okay.
Let's talk about some of the books that History Publishing has recently released.
Well,
all of which, incidentally, I've enjoyed greatly. Words of War, the one you wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful book. We mentioned it earlier on, so I don't want to beat it to death.
Okay.
But HPC seems to have found some favorite authors. The Terry Turchi, Kathleen Puckett team
mm-hmm.
seem very strong. Hunting the American Terrorist and their new release, Homeland Insecurity,
mm-hmm.
are both tour de force stuff. I would imagine that you're pretty happy with both of these books.
Yes, very much so. The Hunting the American Terrorist was the first book that I had from an author other than mine, the first book that was published. That was, and it was a wonderful story behind it. It was an accident that we met. We were introduced by a novelist, by the way. Cynthia Riggs introduced us. And we worked on it. They, at first, when they wrote the first draft, it was like an FBI report. I should mention that they were both FBI agents retired.
<Yeah. laughs>
And they wrote in the most wonderful FBI manner imaginable, and full of content, but it lacked a certain kind of prose that one likes to see. So we turned an editor loose on it, and we turned it into a very workable manuscript. And the interesting thing was that the final draft was done by Dr. Kathleen Puckett, who was a clinical psychologist, and she made it ring, really, a wonderful story. So we should turn the FBI report into a great trade book, and it's a story of the FBI's final pursuit and capture of Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. They were the FBI people who led the chase. Terry Turchi was the unit director, who also, by the way, was an assistant deputy director of the FBI later on. And Kathy was the clinical psychologist in charge of those aspects of the chase, and led very significantly to the recognition of Kaczynski's writings as indicative of being the Unabomber. Mm. And then she was the one who connected and interviewed his brother when he showed up. It was an interesting story. And National Geographic actually did a documentary based on it, so it was it was a wonderful book, and it's still selling nicely. And the other one they did is
Before you move on, let's clinical psychologist
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean much, but I think if we use the term profiler.
Okay.
People might understand better. I mean, this was the lady that profiled Kaczynski, and she was right on the money, as I recall.
And she was. She had him down to a wonderful picture of him in words, I should say. Yes, she was a profiler, but I'd like to mention the fact that as a clinical psychologist, she was a founder of the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Program. She was a heavyweight.
Oh, yeah.
So as a profiler, she accompanied Terry on this chase for Kaczynski, which took them into Montana and, of course, captured him at the cabin. And Kathy got access to all the papers he had there, so she was the one who went over all of his papers and got to know the thinking of the man. And the FBI then asked her to do a study of the 10 most notorious terrorists in the United States that they had in capture, so she was able to do that, which is in the book also. The book won 2 awards, by the way. It won a Forward Magazine as a finalist, and the Independent Press had it down as a Bronze Award winner. So it became a distinguished book last year, and it did very well. It's still selling nicely.
Oh, I think it was a wonderful book, and I can certainly recommend it. Well worth a read. So let's move on. Their latest creation, Homeland Insecurity. Mm-hmm. I like that book a lot.
This is a book that I think Barack Obama must like this book, because I was looking at television yesterday and he was giving an address to his staff members on day one, and he was talking about the transparency of law, the need to have that, or transparency in government. And we must fall back to the rule of law. Those are the two things he was stressing in his address to his new staff members. And those are the two things that were the essence of Homeland Insecurity. The whole idea of this was to profile 11 Washington politicians who really ran afoul of ethics, integrity, and the law, you might say, in compromising national security to secure their own power platforms. It was a study on the addiction to power, and this is where Kathy's expertise lent some extra weight. They looked at the addiction to power that a number of these politicians had and how it distorted their perspective on and what their goals should be. And it was a wonderful book on 11 people who, from Watergate on to the present, have done that. It crosses party lines, by the way. It's not a Democrat or a Republican.
Oh, no, I made a point of pointing that out in my review of it.
This was a book that was designed for the American citizen. Interestingly enough, the mainstream media didn't hook into it because the regional media did. They got on a lot of regional media. They loved it. But the big ones on the networks and all of that were they're tied in with it, you know, the channels of communication, the corridors of power, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a little bit wary of it. Some of them backed off from it because they knew people. They even said it. I'm not going to mention who, but one of them said, "Well, I can't promote this book because I'm good friends of so and so." So this is the reality of what's going on in the world today. And you could see that Obama knows it, and he was talking about it yesterday. And that's a concern of his. And
right.
I really liked what he said yesterday. I thought it was just very, very pertinent. And it connects to this book so well, because this book is a book that it takes the gloves are off on this book. And this is a book that profiles 11 people, as FBI people can do, and they point right at what they've done and how they have distorted Americans' national security to satisfy their own power addiction. Fascinating book.
Also on my favorite list of your authors, in fact, maybe he's even the tops, is the wonderful James Heafey.
Mm.
He's not only a great writer, but a great human being. I loved Le Jet d'Amain.
Jim I think you're right. I love that book. I read that book after it came out. I read it again for the sheer sake of enjoying it. It was such a great book. It is a great book. I love it. It's I get choked up at the end of it too. It's such a wonderful book. Jim is a remarkable guy. He also did another book for us. We have a second imprint, by the way. It's called Today's Books. And Jim, after he got out of, well, to get a little backtrack on the book, when Jim got out of college, he was in the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force, during the Cold War, and he was part of a team Harry Truman sent over to Morocco to whisk Morocco out of the French colonial system. When that system was teetering, and Truman was afraid it would fall into communist hands, so he wanted to get it brought into our sphere of influence. So Jim was part of a team that went over there and did that. And he wrote up this, and it was high adventure. And Jim is such a skilled writer. It was delightful. It was like seeing a movie in your mind because he's such a good writer. And it just flowed, and it was exciting and colorful. And it takes you into Casablanca and Marrakesh and all of these great places that speak of high adventure. And he did a great job on it. And in his later life, he became a very distinguished professor, and he also was a lecturer for the government on organizational matters throughout the United States, and also for GE and IBM. He became very distinguished. We were so lucky to get him.
Indeed. In fact, the other book that you published by him is on a slightly different imprint. I think it's called Today's Books.
That's right, yeah. It's our second imprint. It deals with contemporary issues and how to resolve them on a personal level. Jim's second book was How to Survive in an Organization. And it tells people, this is a book that tells you like it is. It's not one of these business school books. This is a book of reality, and it tells you how to deal with the makeup of the organizational structure, and it's a reality check and tells you exactly how to deal with it, and no bones about it. It's just a terrible book.
I actually enjoyed the book a great deal. I felt that it was a sort of crossover book. It was part biography, part business book, and definitely part humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're right. You captured it right there, Simon. You did. You must have enjoyed the book immensely because you got the three different ingredients of it that make it such a good book.
Now, another recent release, A Lovely Little War.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Simon Lorenzen was a child of privilege. He was an English youngster. His father was was part of a major business over there in China. When World War II broke out, the Japanese were invading China, so they fled to Manila, only to find the Japanese there too. So his father was able to get out, and the mother and his sister and he were captured by the Japanese and put into an internment camp with the infamous Santo Tomas internment camp in Manila. And they were there for 1,112 days. And this is the view of the experience through a child's eyes and how you can see him, those eyes and that person mature as this war goes on. And as the when they're liberated at the end of the war, he finds himself in the middle of the Battle of Manila, which was the most horrific urban warfare site in the entire war. So it was a maturation point for him of the most interesting. So the book was, just came out in October. Angus is now the captain, the president of the civilian ex-prisoners of war in the United States. And he lives in Southern California in Palos Los Verdes, or Rancho Los Verdes, I believe it is. And he's speaking at a convention in February in Fremont, California. He's one of the main figures there in that organization. And he writes a great book, A Lovely Little War. It was a fascinating book. It takes you right into it. And it makes you wonder. I was thinking of my own childhood, and I realized how lucky I've been in my life when someone like him has to go through that kind of horrific period in his formative years. It's amazing how we all have different experiences. And his book reminded me of how lucky I am and or have been in my life. But he came out of it well. He became a very successful individual in life. So.
Okay, I know I've forgotten a few memorable titles, but let's talk for a couple of minutes, because we're running out of time.
Okay.
What's coming up soon from HPC?
Exciting. I got a terrific book. It's called The War of Ideas. It's written by Colonel Carmine Chicaluse, who is head of the information and the psych ops operation in Iraq, and this is the story behind how the surge was made to work.
Oh, no way. I want that. I want in on that one.
You'll get it. The BBC wants it, too. I got a call from them. But I'll get it to you first.
Oh, I get to scoop the BBC?
You'll get
no
to
way.
Scoop the BBC, right. Yeah, I've had calls from different parts of the world for this book, so it's really quite... we're lucky to get it. It was an accident, too. It was an accident. The colonel sent in the stuff to me. He sent in a lot of essays he did, and I looked at them, and then he told me who he was, and he was in charge of this whole thing over there. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I think we got something here that may be a lot more than you're thinking about. So we talked about it. He says, yeah, we could do that. So now we're getting it. He's getting it looked at by the Department of Defense. So they're going to, you know, pass on it. And then I got a general coming in to do the foreword on it. And this is terrific. I can't believe the cooperation I'm getting. What they want out of this book, though, is a primer. They want a primer on because the United States has never been very good at this kind of stuff. You know, the Brits were very good at it, but we were never good at it. And we have to know how to do these things. And so what we're taking is how did we turn the thinking of the Sunni into antagonists of Al-Qaeda, and then how do we unify the Sunni and the Shiites so that they could stop killing each other? So these are the guys who made it work, and this is the story of how it happened.
Wow.
Yeah. how did an independent publisher get this and not Random House?
Yeah, I mean, what were you doing, like robbing mail trucks?
No, he... The colonel sent me in something else he wrote, and then we were chatting, and then I found out who he was, you know, and I said, it was an idea that I had, and we developed it on the phone. So then we went back and forth, and he said he'd have to check and see if the Department of Defense would okay this. So he came back and said, they said, yeah, they would just review it for anything that was ultra classified or something. But
right.
Other than that, you can, they're happy to have it done, because this could be a primer for the future.
Is there a tentative release date?
It'll be June or July. I'm getting the manuscript in the end of next week, the finished manuscript. And so it will be, I was talking to the distributor today, as a matter of fact, and on it, so it'll be June or July. One of the, probably July, maybe July 4th.
what a perfect day.
Right.
Although I suspect most of the bookstores will be closed that day.
They might be, but that's okay. Barnes & Noble will be open.
So, in a minute or less, what else is coming out of History Publishing?
I have a book about this young Jewish guy who was Austrian, and he was in Vienna, and during World War II, and while his mother was hiding Jewish folks in the attic up there in their house, he gets drafted by the German army.
Ooh.
And he wins they send him to the Russian front, and he wins the Iron Cross.
Wow.
Which is their highest award. So this is,
indeed.
He was an artist. He was an artist, and he's also a very gifted writer. And his wife translated the book into it's a terrific book. I can't believe how good this book is. You know, it's such a gifted book. It's a great story. It's ironic. It's funny. They won. You know, he was in the Wehrmacht. He wasn't in the SS, and the SS guys were pretty crazy. You know, bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were the bad dudes, but the Wehrmacht were pretty much like. Draftees, and that's what they were largely. And when they didn't know anything about his background, and then he wanted to make him an officer, but he didn't want to be an officer because they were always up in the front, and that they were the ones getting killed first. So he went and he said, I don't want to become an officer. And the commanding officer said, well, why not? Why don't you want to come? He said, well, I'm Jewish. So he looked at him and he said, oh, okay. Now it did.
Now that would be an awkward moment.
So they were on their way to the Russian front, and I don't think they, I think they were more concerned about getting home than they were anything else. It was I laughed when I saw that, but that's the irony of life, you know. Life is such a strange and fascinating experience, and the journeys we take are so unpredictable in so many ways. And when you read something like that, which is unpredictable, it doesn't conform to the perspective that we have of those settings, you know. So it's interesting to see this. But the book is really quite good. That'll be out, probably be out a little before the other one. The other one had a lot of illustrations in it. It's going to require more work. And I've got a few other books, too, coming down the pike, but they're being worked on now. And I don't know what the titles are yet. We're going to change them.
Right. It has been delightful talking to you. I know that people have listened patiently, and they have no clue where they can find you online. So what is the website for History Publishing?
Well, it's kind of you to ask. It's www, of course, historypublishingco.com.
That's just CO, not
That's
company.
Right. Just CO. HistoryPublishingCO.com.
Don, as I said, always a pleasure chatting with you. This has been delightful, and I can't wait to sample the next things out of History Publishing. You certainly have made for an entertaining show this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Simon, and you're in the top of the list. The books go out automatically to you for your review consideration.
Right. And to think that I'm ahead of the BBC. Mm.
Oh, yeah, well, of course. I mean, you know, first things first, and you're Simon Barrett.
Don, it has been a pleasure. Let's talk again soon.
It's a fun, Simon. Thanks for having me in.
My pleasure. Goodbye.
Take care.